Hey, this is Dr. Eric, and I just want to let you know about my gut healing bundle for those with thyroid and autoimmune thyroid conditions. This includes SMT Probio, which is a probiotic with 18 well-researched strains, Enzymes Plus, which not only includes digestive enzymes, but betaine HCl and ox bile, and SMT GI Restore, which is a stevia-free formulation that has multiple nutrients and herbs that have been proven to help support the healing of the gut. To learn more about this, you can visit guthealingbundle.com. Thank you for joining me on the Save My Thyroid podcast, where I help people save their thyroid and regain their health. My name is Dr. Eric Osansky, and if you have hyperthyroidism, including Graves' disease and toxic multinodular goiter, then you will especially benefit from these episodes. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you also need to save your thyroid, and therefore you will also find many of the episodes to be valuable, including this one where I interviewed Dr. Eric Balkavage as we chatted about thyroid physiology, including the different thyroid blood tests, along with other blood tests. And if you thought you knew everything about testing for vitamin D and iron, you definitely will want to tune into this episode. As usual, make sure you listen to the post-episode chat after the outro music, as I'll expand on whether you should test for both the total and free thyroid hormones, the impact of hypoxia on your health, testing for vitamin D and ferritin, and reverse T3. And you could access the show notes by visiting savemythyroid.com. Anyway, here is my interview with Dr. Eric.
Welcome to the Save My Thyroid podcast, hosted by Dr. Eric Osansky. To stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics, visit savemythyroid.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your doctor. Now let's head to the show.
I am super excited to have a return guest as we are going to have a chat about bile physiology and, of course, tie it into thyroid health. And so we have Dr. Eric Balkavage, who is the owner and founder of Rejuvigen, which is a functional medicine clinic in Chadsford, Pennsylvania. And he is a nationally recognized speaker and educator on various health-related topics, including thyroid physiology, bile physiology, detoxification, oxidative stress, methylation, and chronic illness. Dr. Balkavage is a functional medicine practitioner and a licensed chiropractor in Pennsylvania. And he is also the host of the Thyroid Answers podcast. The podcast focuses on answering the pressing questions those suffering with chronic hypothyroid symptoms can't get answered elsewhere. And you can find his educational Thyroid Thursday videos on both Instagram as well as YouTube. And Dr. Balkavage has made it his mission to change the way medicine looks at hypothyroidism. He is the co-author of the book, The Thyroid Debacle, and the book is co-written by Dr. Kelly Halderman and addresses the problems with current allopathic and functional medicine approaches to hypothyroidism, as well as the solutions to restoring thyroid physiology. And it's always a pleasure welcoming a fellow Dr. Eric. And thanks for joining us again on the podcast.
Thanks, Eric. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah. So really excited to talk about bile and just want to have you jump into it. Before we start recording, you said that years ago you did, was it a three-day conference you mentioned, just focusing on bile physiology?
Yeah. The co-author of my book, Dr. Kelly Halderman, that's why she's the co-author of the book, because I was in the process of writing the book and Kelly reached out to me and said, I need your help on a bile presentation for a supplement company called PHP, Professional Healthcare Products. And I'm like, Kelly, I don't have time to help you with that. I got this book to write. And she's like, I really need your help. And we had gotten together really over a bile presentation I had done for Ben Lynch. When Ben Lynch used to have the Seeking Health conferences, I did a discussion about the significance of bile physiology and as it relates to SIBO. And Kelly was in that presentation and got more interested in biophysiology after hearing that presentation, really got deep into the woods. And that led to us working on that project. So I said, listen, I'll help you with the bile presentation, but then you got to help me work on the book. And you know how this is. Like sometimes you just need somebody else to help keep you motivated to get something done. Kelly needed some of that and I needed some of that with the book. So it all worked out really well.
That is awesome. And yeah, I would have never have thought you could spend so much time talking about biophysiology. So
I don't think the most people want to listen to 3 days of biophysiology, but it was intense and we got really nitty gritty. It was for clinicians, not for the general population. But biophysiology is like so important to our overall health and being. And we wind up just taking gallbladders out and think, hey, nothing changes. Everything's just fantastic. You just, it's just wait, this organ doesn't really need to be there. Let's just get rid of it. But I don't think we really consider how important appropriate biophysiology is in the scheme of metabolism. And we talk about thyroid hormone regulation and in the significance of gut and GI function, critically important, along with significant things like detoxification and getting some of these things that create stress and inflammation in the body out of the body appropriately.
Yeah. So let's talk more about the functions of bile, including the components like the bile acids, the bile salts.
So essentially what bile, you have this tissue called the liver, right? And liver makes this substance we call bile. And it's 95% water, right? Mostly water, which is really important because if you're a person who doesn't drink a lot of water, dehydration could have an impact on the ability to make healthy fluid bile. The other pieces in there, there's cholesterol in there that makes up a big piece of it. There's phospholipids that are in there. There's nutrients in there. There's toxins in there. But essentially what the liver is doing is making this substance that is almost like soap. So that way it can carry these water-soluble substances into the stool, into the urine, so we can excrete it. This kind of soapy substance can also break down fats that are coming into the GI tract so that we can break it down and absorb those fats appropriately into the body so we can use them. And the bile, as from a soap perspective, is cleaning, right? So it has direct and indirect effects on the bacteria coming into the GI tract to help break them down and not allow them to overgrow or colonize, especially the small intestine, small bowel. So bile has really significant impact on a lot of different processes in the body. And it even plays a role in its ability to help regulate potentially the conversion of T4 to T3 in cells and tissues outside the GI tract, because bile acids activate a receptor called TGR5 that increases conversion of T4 to T3. So too much bile acids in circulation could actually create more hyperthyroid signs and symptoms. So it's really important stuff. But we can break it down even more. You just tell me where you want to go.
Yeah, I definitely want to talk more about bile and the thyroid. But it's also involved, you said, it acts like a, I don't know if you want to say antimicrobial, but really keeping bacteria in check, you would say, and other microbes in check.
Yeah. So when we eat food, we put food into our mouth, it goes down into our stomach, and then the stomach produces acid. The role of the acid is to start breaking that food down into what we call chyme. And it's this kind of pre-digested mix of stuff. And then as the chyme is moving into the small bowel, the duodenum, it starts to trigger the release of chemicals from the pancreas, bicarbonate and other and digestive enzymes. And it also triggers the release of the substance that's coming from the liver and the gallbladder called bile. The liver makes bile with the help of thyroid hormone. That bile is excreted into the bile duct and then goes into something called the gallbladder. And in the gallbladder, that bile gets concentrated from maybe a diluted soap to a more concentrated soap. And then when we get the signals from the stomach that, hey, their food is coming in here, then the gallbladder squeezes some of that contents down into the bile tubes. The tube from the gallbladder, the tube from the pancreas come together at something called the sphincter of Oddi. And then those pancreatic enzymes and bile acids enter the upper part of the GI tract to start breaking down the foods into a more absorbable form. But the bile acids and some of those digestive enzymes coming from the pancreas impact the bacteria that's coming from the food and our oral cavity, especially the bile. It's a direct antimicrobial at the upper end of the GI tract. So it can start breaking down the coating of the bacteria with these bile acids. So in the upper part of the GI tract, bile acid is a direct antimicrobial. And then as it, that bile acids and all that food move down the GI tract, the bile acids start to get resorbed in the GI tract. And at the lower end of the GI tract, those resorbed bile acids are an indirect antimicrobial. So as the bile acids are resorbed by the intestines, they're actually initiating defense mechanisms at the lower end of the GI tract to make sure that bacteria doesn't overgrow at the lower end of the small bowel as well. Plays a really important part on the bacterial levels in the bowel, especially in the small bowel, small intestine, because that shouldn't be the area that's as heavily compromised. And I think when we talk about SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIMU, or however you want to say it, small intestinal microbial overgrowth, one of the big things I think is missed in people who are treated for chronic SIBO is that they've lost potentially the innate immune system of that small bowel, which is largely influenced by the amount of bile and the quality of the bile that's moving into the GI tract. So if they don't have good bile flow, then you can kill the bacteria. You can take an antimicrobial and you can knock the bacterial load down. But without the innate immune system that bile plays a big role in, there's a really good chance that the bacteria is going to start to grow back again because you're constantly bringing bacteria from your oral cavity. Bacteria, fungi, and things off your food are constantly coming into the GI tract. So if you lose the direct and the indirect drive of the innate immune system in the GI tract, you're going to probably have reoccurring chronic infections or dysbiosis.
So it's in a way similar to hydrochloric acid, obviously a different location, but HCl, of course, also important for breaking down protein and minerals, but also has antimicrobial effects, just like bile acids.
Yeah. And they do, they both have antimicrobial effects and they both do a little bit different things, right? The acid's really breaking down some of the heavy protein structure and getting that process started. And the acidity of the chyme that's entering the duodenum plays a massive role in what's being released from the surrounding tissues, like what acids, enzymes, bicarbonate, how much of this stuff needs to enter. So if we lose HCl production, then we're going to have the reduced acidity of the chyme. That's going to influence both pancreatic enzyme output, bicarbonate. It's going to potentially impact the amount of bile that's entering into the GI tract. So it does all start from the top. And what else is really important is you need appropriate levels of T3 in the stomach to make stomach acid. You need appropriate levels of T3 at the liver and gallbladder. And you definitely need appropriate levels of T3 at the liver to make appropriate bile and to help regulate bile. And you need appropriate levels of T3 in the GI tract to allow the sphincter of Oddi, this sphincter muscle, to open up to allow the bile and pancreatic enzymes into the GI tract. So thyroid hormone plays a critical role in stomach acid production, bile acid production, but also the release of both pancreatic enzymes and bile into the GI tract. So thyroid hormone's a part of all of these components to a healthy gut function.
Okay, so you explain how thyroid hormone just now affects bile. And also you mentioned how bile affects potentially conversion of T4 to T3. So there's that interplay there. You need healthy thyroid hormones to have healthy bile production, to have healthy conversion of T4 to T3. But maybe not too much bile, like in the maybe as far as supplementation. I was going to save the supplementation for later, but we could talk about it now because when you're taking something like an ox bile supplement, that's essentially bile in a capsule.
Yeah. And so it sounds good on paper, right? If you don't have good fat digestion, then we start to think about maybe I've got a gallbladder issue. So maybe I should just take bile. Now, when we eat food, and the liver is making bile and the gallbladder is releasing bile into the GI tract, that bile is doing its job and then it's being resorbed. About 95% of the bile acids are resorbed back to the liver. And you probably cycle those bile acids 5, 6, 7 times through the process of trying to digest the food. There's primary bile acids, which is what is new bile acids made by the liver. And then there's secondary bile acids, which are when those primary bile acids get into the lower part of the GI tract, into the large bowel, bacteria, which is primarily most of the bacteria in the large bowel, the colon, acts on those bile acids, and they convert those primary bile acids to secondary bile acids. And so we have those both of these things just recycling through the digestive process. A small percentage of those bile acids get out of the hepatic bloodstream and get into the overall bloodstream of the body. And it's those bile acids that play a role to some degree in metabolism, because more bile acids in our overall circulation can then bind to receptors on cells and increase the conversion of T4 to T3. Bile acids, if you're taking ox bile, can be great because that can help somebody who's really struggling with fat digestion. But we've got to be cautious too, because this has happened to me, that I was using ox bile on somebody and they started having hyperthyroid symptoms. And I wasn't aware of this when the person mentioned it to me. This is, gosh, maybe 10 or 15 years ago. And the person said, I think that's my hair's getting thinner and I'm having these symptoms. I think it's the ox bile. And I was like, I don't think so. And I think it might've been like one of the first times I actually used ox bile as a supplement, and the person's having these negative symptoms. And then that's when I really realized, oh, I'm giving them more bile acids than probably they need, or more of those bile acids that I'm providing them in that ox bile is getting into the bloodstream. And that's creating a hyperthyroid effect. As soon as we stopped the ox bile, the symptomatology improved and we're back to normal. Ox bile is it's a really common supplement that people use to help when there's bile issues and gallbladder and fat digestion issues. But I think we have to be cautious with it and be aware that, hey, I could create some hyperthyroid type symptoms at some of the tissues in response to using it. If it's more of it's getting out of that hepatic flow and getting into the bloodstream proper.
I see a lot of people with hyperthyroidism, and I'll admit I've had hyperthyroid patients take bile salts. And I guess the thing is, though, rarely do I give like separate bile salts. I don't know if I've seen maybe the hyperthyroidism has increased and I just wasn't aware of it, but usually when I give it, it's part of the taking digestive enzymes and the betaine HCL, like one of those complexes that have multiple. So maybe it's just a small amount of ox bile compared to if you're giving a separate ox bile supplement that has who knows how much bile salts. Either way, something to be aware of, because even a small amount in some people might be problematic.
Yeah. And prior to that experience, I hadn't really used a lot of ox bile unless, again, it was in like a formula as a part of the formula. But one of my colleagues recommended the ox bile. This is what they use. Why don't you try it? And I'm like, all right, let me try it. Let me see what goes on. It just so happens the first person I tried it with was a learning experience where, ooh, and the patient was fine. It was just one of those things where we both learned, hey, supplements are meant to be supplemental. Just because we think they're all good doesn't necessarily mean they always do what we want them to do, or that there can't be negative consequences from these things. But it's a good learning experience. So for somebody who's thinking they have gallbladder issues or fat malabsorption issues, be cautious. If you have some, if you start to get some hyperthyroid signs or symptoms, and this person was actually starting to have some hair loss as a result of using it, let me try a formula that's got either doesn't have ox bile directly in it or has a much smaller dose of ox bile, and then use some of these formulas that have supportive ingredients that are beneficial.
All right. Thanks for sharing. And then you mentioned the importance of T3. So if someone's having, let's say, a conversion problem, T4, normal T4, low T3, or again, maybe both T4, T3 is a problem, is low. So that also could affect not just bile production, but you mentioned a few other things that could be problematic.
Yeah. So this is a good topic because I think it presents a couple different talking points. So when we think about thyroid hormones effect, the primary impact of thyroid hormone is via T3. In a lot of tissues where most of the T3 is made, there's some tissues that only can use T3 from the bloodstream. There's other tissues that maybe 50% of the T3 that the cell is using is made within the cell. That's important because if we look at somebody who has, we look at their thyroid panel, we see appropriate levels of T4 and low T3, the initial thought process might be, I'll just give them T3 to offset what their body isn't making. And they assume that if we just give them more T3, it's going to have the same effect that the cell would if it was making its own T4 into T3. And unfortunately, that's just not the case. Dr. Bianco, do you know Dr. Bianco? He just wrote a book on thyroid physiology, but he's got theiodinase.org. He's an MD, smart guy, really well known in the thyroid world from a medical standpoint. But Dr. Bianco, we just talked about this the other day because he had a paper where he discussed T3 and how long the T3 that's coming from the bloodstream stays in the cell versus how long the T3 that's made in the cell stays in the cell. And T3 that comes in from the bloodstream, I think that number, it's pretty short, maybe half hour or less, that T3 is in the cell. So it comes in the cell, it goes back out of the cell. But the T3 that's generated inside the cell may stay in that cell for closer to 8 hours. That's significant, right? So it has a different impact when we convert T4 to T3. And I say that because in an effort to maybe think we're optimizing somebody's thyroid physiology or potentially try and make somebody feel good, we see that reduced conversion of T4 to T3 and may say, I'll just give them the T3 and that should fix the problem. And it may manipulate the blood levels, but it may not improve the function of the tissue. Why? Because the tissue, that thyroid hormone, that T3 may not get into the tissue as much as we think it will. We assume that the T3 in the blood correlates with what's inside the cells and tissues, and that's not necessarily the case. And it may not hang out there as long. So when we see somebody maybe who's got reduced T4 to T3 conversion, and we see that they have fat malabsorption issues going on, then what we need to do is ask maybe a better question, which is, what's driving that reduced conversion of T4 to T3 and impacting the liver and the gallbladder and the sphincter of Oddi versus let me just throw more T3 into the system? And in that situation, what should we do for the person who's got fat malabsorption while we try and figure that out? That's where I think we can use these supplementation strategies. Definitely make sure we're supporting there with betaine HCL if they have HCL issues and add some of these good gallbladder support formulas that are available. And there's a ton of them that we can support the fat metabolism while we try and address what's driving the adaptive decreased conversion of T4 to T3, my opinion.
Now, when it comes to taking T3, would you say there's a difference between something like Cytomel synthetic T3 compared to desiccated? I agree with you. You definitely want to try to address the cause of the problem, the conversion problem. But I'm wondering if someone were to take desiccated thyroid over T3, if that would make a difference.
I don't think so, because the challenge becomes, if you think about what's really going on at the cell level, right? If the person has appropriate T4 and they've got an inflammatory cell stress response going on that's reducing the conversion of T4 to T3 and increasing the conversion of T4 to reverse T3, we might look at that and say, let me just give them T3. But the same enzyme, deiodinase 3, that's supposed to be deactivating T4 to reverse T3, will still deactivate T3 to T2. We're just not seeing it. So we might get a temporary change in some symptoms, but long-term, that T3 is not going to stay in the tissues very long. And there's negative implications that come from that, taking that medication. One, we're now chasing the symptoms, so we want more and more. And then as you increase T3 intake, that starts to saturate some of the tissues in the brain and the pituitary gland. And now there's a reduction in TSH. And then when you have a reduction in TSH, if you were getting some output from the thyroid gland, now you get less T4 production by the thyroid gland. So now you've got to make a decision. If I'm increasing the T3 to try and have an effect, is that then saturating the central axis, resulting in less T4 production by the gland? And now I either need to provide more T4 or I'm going to need to provide more T4 and T3 based on what the provider's trying to do. And at the same time, we still may not have addressed what's creating that cell stress response. We haven't addressed what's resulting in the reduced T4 to T3 conversion, and we still may not improve the function
of the tissues that are struggling. We may see changes in the blood value, but the blood value doesn't always correlate with what's going on inside the various tissues. They can all self-regulate to some degree independently of what's in the bloodstream.
Makes sense. Now, if T3 is really low, let's say if it was like 1.5 free T3 on a blood test, obviously you're going to still want to address the cause of the problem, but would you be in favor of giving T3 on a temporary basis? Or would you say it depends on the person, the symptoms?
I would say it depends on the situation. So when we think about why somebody might have low T3, there's three big considerations we have to take. Is the person have low T3 because the gland is not producing enough T4 or they're not taking enough T4? We have to evaluate that. Even though we've gotten away from running total T4, it doesn't mean it doesn't have value. It does. So if you just have free T4 and it's normal, high or low, it still doesn't tell us what the total is. Is the thyroid gland making enough thyroid hormone? And we may not know. So you could look at reverse T3 and say, if I've got high reverse T3 and I've got a normal or high free T4, then maybe I am making enough T4 at the thyroid gland, but we don't know. So I think it's important to run it. But if the thyroid gland isn't producing enough T4 and you're not taking T4 medication, that could be one of the reasons why T3 and free T3 are low. And we'll know that by looking at a fuller thyroid panel. When we look at the totals, we get an idea. The other thing we can do is we should be able to take a look at the free T3 to free T4 ratio. And if we look at the free T3 to free T4 ratio, if there's a global hypothyroid condition, the gland's not making enough, there's not enough T4 in the bloodstream, what we should see when we look at that free T3 to free T4 ratio is a higher ratio of free T3 to free T4. Why? Because the cells are starving for thyroid hormone and they want that converted into the usable form as quickly as they can get it. So in a true hypothyroid, glandular hypothyroid condition where there isn't enough T4 and T3 in the system, not enough T4 in the system, and the T3 and free T3 are low, in that situation, we would look at that and say, ooh, this is a person who either needs iodine because it can't make enough that hormone, right? Or there's destruction of the gland and they're going to need some support. Now, in that situation, would I recommend T4 and T3? I don't prescribe, but in that situation, I would say it's probably appropriate to give the T4 first and see how they convert. The second reason somebody might have a lower T3 or free T3 is that they have some cell stress inflammatory mechanism going on. And it's an adaptive change where the body's not wanting to convert T4 to T3. And that's why it's low. And if that's the case, then we'll see that free T3 to free T4 ratio be low. And in that situation, I wouldn't recommend more T3 because if the body is trying not to convert T4 to T3 and we give them more T3 that the body probably didn't want, is that helping them? And you could say, sure, their signs and symptoms feel better. But am I really helping them? That's the question, right? If your patient has a fever, should you give them aspirin or Tylenol to reduce the fever? And somebody might say, sure, it'll make them feel better. And I would say, maybe not. I'll give them a cool compress and put them to bed because if they spike the fever, the fever isn't the problem. It doesn't make us feel good, but the fever, its job is to help in the healing process, right? People could argue both sides. In a situation like that, again, I would say, no. The third reason that somebody might have reduced conversion of T4 to T3 and have a lower total T3 and free T3 is they're just taking way too much T4 if they're taking medication. Because too much T4 in circulation results in the ubiquination of deiodinase 2. So they turn down that T4 to T3 conversion in the peripheral tissues, and now they're going to have a lower T3 and free T3. So in that situation, again, I wouldn't recommend more T3. I would recommend that they reduce the T4 dose. And the fourth issue that we have to take into consideration is that this could be a person who has a genetic polymorphism, just does not convert T4 to T3 very well. And if that's the case, that's the person that I would consider, hey, I know they've got genetic polymorphisms. They're one of the 15% of the population that could have up to a 20% reduction in T4 to T3 conversion in the periphery in that person, I would say it might be justified to do it. And then the fifth situation would be somebody who's had a thyroidectomy, had their gland damaged, radiation, whatever. The thyroid gland typically makes 5 to 10 micrograms per day. So in that situation, if I'm trying to mirror, if we're taking away the gland's function, then we should mirror the production. And that should be maybe somewhere between the 5 and 10 micrograms that the thyroid gland would traditionally make. So in that situation, I would say that's a person who probably needs T3. No, when somebody just has low T3 or free T3, I don't like them to just be on thyroid medication just to improve some of their symptoms, because my goal with my clients is to figure out how to help that T4 to T3 conversion. And it's my feeling that in a lot of cases, giving the T3, while it may create short-term benefit, is problematic in the long run into helping normalize normal homeostatic thyroid physiology.
Hey, this is Dr. Eric. And if you're looking to do everything you can to save your thyroid, in addition to listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways we can help you. First of all, I've written 3 books on thyroid health, 2 related to hyperthyroidism and 1 related to Hashimoto's, and you can get all of them on Amazon, or to learn more about them, visit savemythyroid.com/thyroidbooks. Second, you can also join my Graves' disease and Hashimoto's healing community by visiting savemythyroid.com/thyroidgroup. And finally, if you want to get personal help from me, you can visit the website workwithdrerick.com. Just to let you know, I only see a limited number of new patients each month, and I do require anyone interested to complete a brief online application before working with me. And now back to the show.
All right. Thanks for that explanation. I know we got off track with the bile metabolism, but thought it was important to bring that up. You did chat a little bit about this during our first conversation, especially the testing the total T4 and not just relying on the free hormones, especially in the case of hypo. I don't know what hyperthyroidism, I still just test free T4, free T3, but it does make sense with hypothyroidism when looking at the total output of thyroid hormone, not just to rely on the free hormones.
Yeah. And the other thing, I don't remember if we talked about it or not, but when we look at the free hormones, we also have to consider, is the free hormone low because of what's going on with the binding globulins? So the binding globulins, those transport proteins, can have an impact on how much is actually free. And then what influences those, right? So estrogen increases those binding globulins. Taking too much thyroid medication can potentially increase those binding globulins. So there's things that influence the free values. And if we're only looking at it in isolation, are we really seeing the full picture? I don't think we are. So I think we need to take a look at that. Now, if somebody's hyperthyroid, we know they got plenty of thyroid hormone available. That's usually not the issue. So sometimes these things are, depending on what your patient population is, it may change it. My patient population is primarily people that are struggling with hypothyroid symptoms or over-medicated or trying to find a magical dose. I do get some hyperthyroid-based patients. A lot of times if I get them, I say, call Dr. Eric. This is what he does every day. Check with him. See if he's a great match for you. Since this is what he does every single day, that might be the better match. But I do have patients that want to work with me that have hyperthyroidism, or they've had treatment for hyperthyroidism and now they're on thyroid medication and now they're back in the wheelhouse of how do I find that magic dose? And I'm like, yeah, in that situation, if you're on the weight and age appropriate dose for somebody who doesn't have a gland and it's not working, then you have what I talk about every day. There's still some type of cell stress, that response that's going on that's driving the immune inflammatory process. And in those situations, once we get them close to what the thyroid gland would have made, then we got to get busy trying to find those stress responses. So even though we both work in the thyroid world, what labs you think are important and what the labs I think are important is really going to be centered around our patient population of what we deal with.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Now, you mentioned estrogen, the effect of estrogen on the binding globulins, but I also wanted to ask you about estrogen and its impact on bile metabolism as well.
Estrogen, and especially excessive estrogen, can have an impact on A, thyroid hormone production can have an impact on iodine intake into the thyroid glands. It can have an effect there because if you reduce iodine or thyroid hormone production, obviously that can trigger problems downstream and thyroid hormone's ability to regulate biophysiology. As we have increased estrogen, we just talked about this, estrogen can influence the binding proteins. So because it can influence the binding proteins, that can reduce the amount of available T4 and T3 to get into the liver and the bile ducts and help with that regulation. And estrogen also impacts what we call that sphincter of Oddi, which is the valve that needs to open into the duodenum to allow bile flow and pancreatic enzymes to move into the GI tract. And so if you have too much estrogen in the system, that can cause constriction of the sphincter of Oddi, keep it tight, keep it from opening up. And then that can lead to problems with reduced bile flow into the GI tract. So that can lead to fat malabsorption, gas, bloating, pressure, loose stools, permeability issues, inflammation. And it can also cause the bile to become thicker and lead to stone formation and then lead to gallbladder disease. Unfortunately, we need estrogen. Estrogen's really important. But when we take a look at any of these systems, regardless of what somebody's diagnosis is, we have to figure out how these systems all tie in and what's causing it. So if we have fat malabsorption, maybe signs and symptoms or fat malabsorption on a stool test, we might rush in there with some bile support. I often do because I understand how important it is. Okay, let's get you absorbing, get some support here for the fats and fat digestion. But then let's start to consider what are all the possibilities or probabilities that are resulting in reduced T4 to T3 conversion and what else might be impacting bile production and bile flow into the GI tract. And especially for women, estrogen issues could be tops of the list.
And so if someone's taking an oral contraceptive, so that also could potentially lead to, depending on what they're taking, but that could lead to...
Yeah, depending on what's in there, for sure.
Yeah. So that could lead to gallstones by making the bile thick and sluggish.
Yeah. And I think we, obviously, if somebody's got a gallbladder disease, the tissue's diseased and it's problematic, I get it. Maybe it has to come out. But if we just remove the gallbladder and just have the duct straight from the liver into the GI tract, and we still have a T4 to T3 conversion issue, or we still have an estrogen issue, did we really fix anything? We took the diseased tissue out, but now we've lost the concentration of the bile. So it's not as effective. It doesn't have the same antimicrobial effect. It doesn't have the same ability to break down those fats appropriately. It doesn't have the same ability to absorb those free fatty acids across the membrane. It doesn't have the same effect that this more concentrated bile might have. It would be like washing your dishes with like a concentrated soap versus a really watered down diluted soap. It just doesn't have the same effect. But I think that happens all the time where people, oh, you just have gallbladder disease. We'll take your gallbladder out and you're going to be good. Well, the first question we should be asking is, what are the issues that cause that gallbladder to become diseased to begin with? What was the patient's estrogen level? What's their T4 to T3 conversion? Do they have dysbiosis? What are their lipids like? Is there cholesterol in the bloodstream high? And maybe that's having an effect on bile absorption. Are there things blocking the transport of bile flow in and out? What are the reasons that we have these issues and these problems versus just take it out and you're good? But I think that happens too often.
Yeah, it's definitely want to try to fix the problem before it gets to that point. Years ago, my dad, when I was a teenager, he had to get his gallbladder removed before I had the knowledge I had now. So to me, it was a big deal because he was getting the surgery, but they told him, of course, the same thing, no problem living without a gallbladder, and never even thought about addressing the cause. Again, it might have been too late. It's been a long time, so I don't remember everything. So by that time, even if he wanted to address the cause, it might have been too far gone. But there's a lot of people things can do before it gets to that point, is what you're saying.
Yeah. And I think the other thing we have to consider for the patient is, how would I even know if I have a bile issue or a gallbladder issue or a problem with the production? Gas, bloating, reflux, loose stools, greasy stools. You go to the bathroom and there's stool stains on the side of the bowl. Some people talk about floating stools because maybe there's more fat in the stool. I've seen literature that says it's more likely it's going to be greasy stools, or when you wipe, it's going to be, you're going to have to wipe a bunch of times. That's a greater indication that there's higher fats in the stool. And even the reflux, I think a lot of people, they're told they have too much stomach acid that's causing the reflux, but you can get bile reflux if you're not breaking those fats down appropriately. But if you've got gas, bloating, pressure, loose stools, greasy stools, just indigestion when you eat fats, there's a good indication that you're starting to develop some challenges with your bile production.
And similar, if someone has issues with fish oils, if they take fish oil supplements and they're experiencing a lot of burping, belching, that could be a sign too?
I think it could be. I guess there's some argument about the quality of all the oils that we're buying. Are they oxidized, not oxidized? Somebody gave me a bit of an in-depth education on the fats and was like, hey, to really make a high quality fish oil derivative product is difficult, really difficult, because it's easily oxidized in the processing. And so a lot of the sometimes of what may be creating issues, maybe it is liver, gallbladder issues, and maybe it's the quality of the product we're getting. And unfortunately, just looking at the back of the label may not give us the, how would you know? The average person probably wouldn't be able to know. You're just buying fish oils or a fish oil derivative. But if you're eating anything, those types of things, or you're eating a lot of fats in a diet and you're having more indigestion, burping, belching, looser stools, it's a good chance that you're having some challenges.
How about high bilirubin? I wanted to talk to you about that and Gilbert's. Some will say that Gilbert's is not really a big deal. When I went through my Institute of Functional Medicine training, I don't know if you're familiar with Dr. Robert Roundtree.
I know the name. I don't know him personally.
Yeah, he was teaching the detox course, and he actually was saying, he was like showing literature showing that it was a big deal, that you can't just overlook something like Gilbert's, even though there's a genetic component. So I wanted to get your thought about Gilbert's, high bilirubin in general.
I think it's generally learned in school that as bilirubin levels are going up in the blood, we've got problems with liver and gallbladder function. Do I think it's important? I don't care what disorder somebody's named or hasn't named. If your bilirubin is going up, you've got a problem. And there's a breakdown of liver and gallbladder problem. Somebody might say AST, ALT are still good, so it's not an issue. That's nonsense. The vast majority of people, if they have elevated bilirubins, we should take notice regardless of what the diagnosis is. It shouldn't be that high. Okay, I have a genetic predisposition to maybe that being higher. And if everything else, there's no signs, there's no symptoms, everything else looks good. Okay, maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's not important. I think it's really unusual that you see an elevated bilirubin and there's not something going on. So for the listener, bilirubin is, it's a waste product. So we break down red blood cells and the heme in red blood cells into something called biliverdin. And that gets converted into something called bilirubin. And that bilirubin is in your bile and it should go out. If we're starting to see higher levels of bilirubin in the blood, that means it's not getting through the liver and the gallbladder and is building up in the bloodstream, and that's potentially problematic. Bilirubin, just so you know, the reason your stool is brown is because of bilirubin. The reason your urine's yellow is because of bilirubin. But somebody says, hey, you've got clay-colored stools. The reason they're clay-colored is you don't have as much bilirubin getting into the stool to actually make it that darker, pretty black brown color. So it does give some of the pigmentation. So I think if it's elevated, it should be a warning sign to a clinician. I usually look at a range somewhere like 0.5, 0.8. If it's in that range, we're probably good. But again, then we have to also take a look at, where's my red blood cells? Or am I anemic and I'm at 0.8? If I'm anemic and I'm 0.8, maybe that's too high versus if I'm not anemic. The other thing is a big issue is the low bilirubin, which I think gets really no attention at all. If you look at a lab report, as long as it's less than 1.2, you're good. I don't think that's the case either. And I think that low bilirubin, when we think about that, what does that mean? Does that mean I have a gallbladder problem? I don't know that it means you have a liver problem or a gallbladder problem, but it probably means you have an oxidative stress problem, because bilirubin can be converted back to biliverdin, and biliverdin is a potent antioxidant. So the body can help deal with the oxidative stress in the body by, instead of excreting the bilirubin, just couldn't convert it back into biliverdin so it can have an antioxidant effect. So I think we need to look at the highs and the lows. And even when it's normal, we have to interpret it based on what our other values are. But I would say, to summarize that, regardless of what the diagnosis is, if you start to see your bilirubin creeping up above 0.8, you got to start to look at the rest of the labs, ALT, AST, GGT. You can look at the AST-ALT ratio. If that is elevated, then we have to start considering that that's a person who's already developing fatty liver disease. And if they're starting to develop fatty liver disease, is that going to affect bile function and bile physiology? Absolutely. If they're starting to develop fatty liver disease, what does that mean about thyroid physiology? That means they probably don't have great T4 to T3 conversion supporting the liver. And so then I can't burn those fats as a fuel. I can't burn the glucose as a fuel. So definitely, I think when you think about that bilirubin number, regardless of the diagnosis, if it's creeping above 0.8, somebody should take notice. If it's below 0.5, we should take notice and say, what the heck is going on here with the oxidative stress or with this liver, gallbladder physiology?
Yeah, that's interesting. I admit I'm guilty of not paying attention to lower bilirubin, like being too low, just because it's not red flagged if it's low. And I know you can't just rely on labs, but I do look at high side and low side, but just never knew that if it gets too low, that could be potentially an oxidative stress problem. So that's good to know.
Yeah. Again, we have to take a look at the red blood cell population, right? Because if they have an anemia pattern, then it might be low just because they're anemic, right? So there's not as much red blood cells breaking down. The red blood cells are hanging around longer because I don't make as many. This goes back to interpretation, which hopefully what we do better maybe than sometimes in allopathic medicine where they're just looking for an H and L, do I need to treat? In functional medicine, we should be interpreting the labs and saying, what story do these labs tell us about my client? Like, how does that match with their signs and symptoms? That way we can be more specific with a treatment strategy.
Makes sense. So for current gallstones, there are all these remedies out there. And you mentioned as far as supplements, not necessarily for a gallstone specifically, but just supporting bile metabolism, not just bile salts, but there are other supplements, like things with beets, for example, to help with bile metabolism as well. But if someone has an existing gallstone, and if it's not serious, if it's not like blocking a bile duct or anything like that, is there anything they could do as far as shrinking the stone or breaking the stone? Or are those things that are out there not really breaking gallstones?
There's a lot of things that are out there for gallbladder cleanses and from hydrogen peroxide that people drink and to try and break up the stones. I don't try to do that necessarily. I don't have people do them. I think the chances of things going well, maybe they're good, maybe they're not good. I have had patients in the past that did these things and wound up with emergency gallbladder removal because what happened with whatever they were doing, using some fats and hydrogen peroxide or whatever their cleanse was that they were doing, actually created more stress and expansion and inflammation in the tissue. Some of these strategies are trying to force the flow. But if there's things restricting flow and then you're creating this real need to force the emptying of the gallbladder, you're going to be in trouble, right? And I don't typically recommend those strategies. I think the better model here is there's a number of different supplements that are out there on the market that are either designed to help support better bile production or to support healthier bile flow. And lots of companies have those things out there. And I would suggest that whoever thinks they have issues, definitely work with your functional medicine practitioner so they can guide you in the right direction as to what might be the best strategy in your situation. But that's step one. Step two is what's causing this problem to begin with.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I just want to get your perspective. I don't recommend anything to break up gallstones. And like you said, there's risks as well of doing that too. It's just because it's a supplement that you're taking doesn't mean that there's absolutely no risk. And like you said, you could end up in the ER. Not to say it'll happen most of the time, but even if it's 10% of the time or whatever percentage, it's that risk. So I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah. And I think I read a paper a while ago and they started breaking down those gallstones. And it was interesting. In this one paper I read, what they were finding was a lot of bacteria at the center of those stones. So what was the underlying cause? So one of those things we have to consider is bacteria getting into the somewhere in that area of the body, maybe getting up the duct into the gallbladder. Is the stone really the problem in some of these situations? Or again, is that the body's adaptive response? Hey, we've got this bacteria. Let's surround it and encase it, versus that obviously they can be a problem, especially if they create a congestion issue. The point of that is the body's pretty cool. A lot of the things we think are the problem are the body's adaptation to try and protect itself. So in a situation like that, if we actually knew that, and we don't typically have the ability to, okay, let me pull a, hey, there's a gallstone. Let me pull that out, throw it under a microscope at home and see what's at the center of it. But that's one of the things we have to consider is what's going on even from a gallbladder function or dysfunction related to organisms. And it can be.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you is life after gallbladder surgery. If someone sees you, they've already had gallbladder removed, so they're still having the underlying bowel metabolism problems. Does that person necessarily need to be on support permanently since they don't have a gallbladder? Or is it still just a matter, obviously you want to address the problem, the cause of the problem, but once it's addressed, can they be off of, let's say, bile support supplements? Or is that something you think they need to take continuously?
I tend to lean towards people using something longer term. But again, I would look at labs and signs and symptoms. And we can look at sometimes on a stool test and see markers of fat malabsorption, whether it's steatocrit or high cholesterol or high triglycerides or whatever in the stool. If we see higher fats in the stool, it's a good indication that this is maybe a person who's not absorbing their fats very well. So in that situation, we might want to do it. We might want to have them on it. If it looks like they're a person who, and especially if you look at their labs, if their triglycerides and VLDL are relatively low and even LDL is relatively low, we might consider they're not doing a great job of absorbing triglycerides into the system. Because as you well know, the difference between VLDL and LDL and HDL is the amount of triglycerides in ratio to cholesterol that's on those lipoproteins. And so if their triglycerides are low and you ask them what they're eating, if that's what they're eating and their triglycerides are low and their VLDL is really low, this is a person who probably is going to need some bile support, some gallbladder support. So we typically, triglycerides is another one of those things where the lab range says like less than 150 or less than 145 or whatever. But whether it's high or low, it's telling us a story. If I have somebody who's got low triglycerides and low VLDL, but has blood glucose issues and other issues going on, there's a good chance that they have fat malabsorption going on, especially if they have chronic mineral deficiencies. You really have to look that way. But I wouldn't say it's a blanket statement. Everybody has to have it. I would lean towards that most people are going to need some support because they've lost that fat concentrating or the bile concentrating ability when they've lost their gallbladder.
What triglycerides, what would you consider too low, like less than 50?
Yeah, probably under 50. But it would depend on what their diet was like, right? That would be a little flag for me. If I saw it under 50, I'd be like, what's going on here? Tell me what you're eating. All right, based on that, let me look at that VLDL. That's low too. Tell me about your stools. Tell me about your gas, bloating, pressure. If the picture sounds right, put them on it. If you do a stool test and you can see elevated steatocrit, or you do maybe Vibrance gut zoomer test and your triglycerides and cholesterol and those things elevated, they're getting some support.
All right. Makes sense. So this was amazing. Is there anything else that I should have asked you that I didn't ask you with relation to biophysiology? Again, you spent 3 days, so I'm sure there's another few hours we could go on, but anything really urgent?
Bile acids also play a critical role, not just in the immune system of the GI tract, but the permeability of the GI tract. They help to manage those tight junctions. So for the person who's maybe been told multiple times, hey, you have chronic leaky gut, and especially if you've had multiple episodes of chronic dysbiosis and nobody's looked at bile physiology for you, that really should be considered because the bile acid resorption helps maintain the tight junctions of the GI tract. It is not just an issue about fat digestion. It's not just an issue about antimicrobial capacity at the top end, but if you don't have healthy biophysiology, it can lead to the chronic leaky gut. And then most of us are aware it can lead to chronic inflammation, food reactivity, food intolerances, even systemic infections from what's going on in the GI tract.
Yeah, that's important since that leaky gut is pretty prominent.
Yeah, could be.
All right. Yeah. Again, this was amazing. Thank you for getting together again to discuss biophysiology. And where can people find out more about you, Dr. Eric?
They could see me, the Thyroid Answers podcast, which you've been a guest on, and sometime we'll get you back again, pretty much wherever you get your podcasts. As you said, the Instagram and Facebook, I guess I'm on too, where we do our Thyroid Thursday videos. And I do a lot of answering questions on there. The book is The Thyroid Debacle. And then my website is rejuvenegencenter.com, and they can reach out there. I do discovery calls. Every day I do at least 2 discovery calls over my lunch break to help answer questions for people. They're not quite sure where to go or what to do, or they're confused about their health in some way or their thyroid physiology. And I use that time along with the other platforms to just help give people the answers that they're just looking for that maybe aren't getting elsewhere.
All right. Wonderful. Yeah. Of course, include that in the show notes. And we'll also include a link to his previous interview that we did in the show notes as well. And again, thank you so much, Eric. This was great. Again, appreciate you taking the time to really dive deep into biometabolism.
I appreciate the opportunity, Eric.
Thank you for listening to the Save My Thyroid podcast. If you haven't done so already, make sure you hit subscribe to stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics. And to get your free thyroid and immune health restoration action points checklist, visit SaveMyThyroidChecklist.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.
So that was an awesome interview with return guest Dr. Eric Balcavage. Yeah, it's just so knowledgeable. And this was kind of like a second part when it comes to gallbladder and biometabolism. And so really what happened is Dr. Eric was on my podcast previously to talk about thyroid physiology. And then we spoke about, after that, eventually having him come on to talk about biometabolism. And so we eventually scheduled it a few months out. And then I had someone else contact me, Divya Gupta, who focuses on gallbladder. And so first I was going to have them maybe a few months apart, just having Dr. Eric first since he committed first. But then he was scheduled out for a little bit, and then I interviewed Divya Gupta. And so I figured I would put them back to back with Divya first, just because it is more basic, whereas Dr. Eric gets more into the physiology, so a little bit more advanced. And so hopefully it goes well. Just I don't want people to get sick of gallbladder and biophysiology. I haven't had any episodes up until this point. Actually, I did have a Q&A episode talk about bile salts, very short episode. So anyway, oral contraceptives and gallstones. So I brought that up just because it was a learning experience. So years ago, my staff person was taking oral contraceptives and was developing gallstones. And at the time, I didn't know any better about the oral contraceptives causing gallstones. And unfortunately, she ended up getting gallbladder surgery. And so I thought it was important to bring it up, not because I'm preaching to everybody who's taking the pill to stop it, but just to let people know about the risks, because I'm sure she's not the only one. My staff person wasn't the only one who was taking oral contraceptives and got their gallbladder removed. So I don't know how many times that has happened, but I'm sure lots and lots of times. Bile acids and SIBO, or small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. He also said SIMO. I never heard SIMO, small intestinal microbial overgrowth. Usually it's either SIBO or SIFO, which is small intestinal fungal overgrowth. But again, fascinating how bile acids can keep bacteria and other microorganisms in check, which that I knew, even though I was comparing it with HCL, something I definitely was familiar with. I don't think it's a number one cause of SIBO. I've been doing a lot of research with SIBO, not as much more recently, but over the years, that is one of the potential causes. As far as I know, one of the main causes, if not the main cause, is the autoimmune process to a migrating motor complex. And that's the cleansing way of the small intestine. And if someone has damage to that, that's going to result in a buildup of bacteria in the small intestine. But we can't overlook the impact of bile acids or having insufficient bile acids. So ox bile and hyperthyroidism, I wanted to make it clear because I'm sure there are people listening to this who have taken ox bile supplements, and some of them, my patients, because I commonly recommend an enzyme. I have an enzyme, my own part of my supplement line, Enzymes Plus, that has digestive enzymes, betaine ATL, and has some ox bile, but again, has a small amount. So it's actually part of a proprietary blend of, again, enzymes and ox bile. And even the betaine HCL is a lower amount. Like if you take betaine HCL separately, it would be usually like 500 milligrams and it's 200 milligrams. So yeah, I really haven't seen people taking that supplement or other supplements that have ox bile and have an issue, but it's something to be aware of. And if someone's taking a separate ox bile supplement or multiple ox bile supplements and they have hyperthyroidism, again, it's good to be aware of. So I'm glad he brought it up, but didn't want people to be alarmed who have hyperthyroidism and who've been taking either my supplement or something else. Again, listen to your body. If you take anything and you're feeling more hyper, then maybe take a break from it and then see how you feel. And then so low bilirubin and oxidative stress, I need to do more research on that because, again, that was new to me as far as it being too low, which, again, it makes sense. I mean, there are markers that are okay being really low. So what he said did make sense. I'll need to do a little bit more research on that. And then I also want to mention that hyperthyroidism itself sometimes can cause high bilirubin. So if you have hyperthyroidism and if your bilirubin is high, it might not be a problem related to like bile metabolism. It might just be related to the hyperthyroidism. Of course, you could have both issues, hyperthyroidism and a problem with bile metabolism. What I would do is I would look at your labs before you were diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, like even a few years back, and see what the bilirubin levels looked like before you conclude that it's a problem. And if it was elevated prior to that, then maybe you're dealing with Gilbert's and he agreed that it's something that you probably want to address, even though you might not be able to completely normalize because there are genetics involved with Gilbert's. But he did mention high bilirubin is never good. So again, if someone has hyperthyroidism, I'm not saying it's good or not a concern, but if it's related to the elevation in thyroid hormone, then obviously you want to do things to lower thyroid hormones to help with the bilirubin. Also brought up supplements for breaking gallstones. So again, we're definitely in favor of the time and place for supplementation to support bile metabolism, but there are people that have known gallstones and they try to break them up. And again, I can't say I recommend specific supplements for that purpose. I mean, to be fair, most people, when they see me, they're not coming with gallstones, but there are people who have worked with me over the years and for whatever reason, you know, maybe develop gallstones. Again, trying to think if that has been the case. A small sample size, I guess, because of the diet they've been following, it's not too common, but I know I've had a few patients talk about breaking gallstones. Again, it's been at least a few years. So thankfully, it's not something I have to deal with regularly. Dr. Bakovich, maybe, because again, he deals a lot with bile metabolism and Hashimoto's. Arguably with Hashimoto's, it is more common. And Divya Gupta spoke about this as well. She has had her gallbladder removed, also has a history of Hashimoto's. So again, she might see more people that will have existing gallstones, which would make sense since she focuses on that. But, you know, I've heard stories. I don't think I ever experienced or met someone who tried to do that and where it caused problems or resulted in them going to the ER. So I don't know anybody personally, but I've heard the same stories that Dr. Eric mentioned where someone was trying to do that and then they did end up in the ER. Again, no personal stories, but just general stories where that happened. And so, yeah, it might be low risk, but yeah, you just want to be careful, really. The goal shouldn't be to break up gallstones necessarily, but the main goal is to try to fix the cause behind the gallstones, to address the bile metabolism problem. So ideally, you don't have gallstones to begin with. So hopefully, you learned a lot from this conversation. Again, Dr. Eric sometimes could really get advanced. And before we chatted, we spoke about this a little bit, and he didn't want to get too advanced, but some of it, nevertheless, I think was a little bit possibly over some people's heads. But again, hopefully you found this lesson, hopefully you found, felt like a lesson, right? Felt like a lesson. But hopefully you found this episode to be valuable. And as usual, look forward to catching you in the next episode.
I want to let you know about a product called Hepatoimmune Supreme, which is a unique supplement that has a rare combination of N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, milk thistle, and schisandra to support the liver. And it also has a few mushrooms that can help support the immune system, including cordyceps, which has both immune modulating and adaptogenic properties and is great for those with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's. To learn more about Hepatoimmune Supreme, visit savemythyroid.com/liver support.